Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so on this podcast, I share ideas and strategies. I talk about things that work, but also those epic fails I've made along the way. I provide some protocols like I did in the last podcast episode about AI and deeper learning. And then I also talk about some of the big picture things that go on. And I gotta say, before we get started, I just wanna say that you can find my website at spencereducation.com. You can contact me at john@spencereducation.com or john@spencerauthor.com. And please consider signing up for the newsletter. I share exclusive resources there. I share the blog post every time it comes out, podcast when it comes out. And it's just a great way to get my stuff straight in your mailbox. And the other thing I want to say is I've had a really busy spring with keynotes and workshops, and it's been so fun to run into people who listen to this podcast. And I just want to say I'm genuinely honored when I run into someone who actually listens, because it can sometimes feel lonely just putting content out to the world and not always being sure who's listening. And it's just me chilling in my office, sharing my thoughts, hanging out with Zeus and Athena, my two great Danes. And so thank you for listening. I just want to say that ahead of time. Today we're going to talk about two things that we talk about a lot on this podcast, which is AI and creativity. And so today's episode name is a little bit long. Centaurs, Cyborgs, and Coffee-Bearded Logos, 7 Ways AI is Changing Creativity. And I'm really excited about this particular topic. A little bit of a backstory. I'm going to reference some visual things that are just going to be tough to imagine. So if you go to the blog post that corresponds to this, spencereducation.com/AI-creativity, you'll be able to see it. Or just go to the articles page and it'll be the first thing that you see. So, but I want to begin by sharing how much AI-generated content has changed and what that means for the future of creativity and for our students. So AI didn't make art, but it got the hands right this time. That's what I want to share. About a week and a half ago or so, I don't really know. I'm thinking like 10 days ago. I don't know. ChatGPT released their newest version of image generation. And we are now seeing a flood of Studio Ghibli-style AI-generated images. And notice I have twice already said AI-generated images. I don't use the word art deliberately. About 3 years ago, I used the term AI-generated art, and my son Micah responded with, AI doesn't create art, it generates images. Only humans can create art. Let me say that again. Only humans can create art, and I love that. But I do think it helps sometimes to say, how is machine learning advancing and changing, and what does that mean for art? What does it mean for creativity? And we'll get there in a moment, but I want to tell you a little bit about some of the changes that I've seen. The first thing is that right off the bat, you'll notice that AI imagery is finally getting the text correct. That used to be the dead giveaway that someone had used AI in their visuals was just like mumble jumbled text that made no sense. But it's gotten way, way better. I asked ChatGPT to generate a book cover for my upcoming book called The Depth Advantage, Deeper Learning in a Distracted World. And I gotta say, it did a really good job. It went with the color scheme I wanted, which was purple. And it has this like image with a brain on one side and clutter brain on the other side. And it's all of the words are correct. I mean, that's the bottom line. The words are phenomenal. On a side note, I want to say I'm still gonna make my own book covers. Like that's my style. Just like I did with other book covers that I made with, you know, Vintage Innovation, AI Roadmap, Launch, Empower, all those different book covers. So that's not gonna change. But I did find it fascinating that it got the text correct. The second thing that you'll notice is that photorealistic images are just, they're actually photorealistic now. If there's a, I give an example of, you know, a man painting, and I gave the prompt of a left-handed man painting, it gave me a right-hander both times. But the second image, the newer one, it's just more accurate. The windows look real. They don't look all kind of like funky and wavy. The lighting looks more real, but the person looks real. He's got, you know, a couple bumps on his face. He's got a beard that looks like a real beard. They've really hammered that. The ability to get clothing correct is great. Wrinkles, it looks real. In the past, most of the images had this weird glossy plasticky feel. It was like an Instagram filter gone wrong. But now they look real. Like if you saw this image that I share on this of the before and after of the prompt, show me a couple on their wedding day, it's vastly different. And one of them looks like a photograph, one of them looks like a video game, right? Notice that it still gets bias wrong. It cannot make images of a left-handed painter. It will screw it up every time. But it does a great job. And on the topic of realism, you're gonna notice that the eyes and the hands are all finally correct. For the longest time, image generators like DALL-E had a hard time with eyes and hands. And you would often get six fingers, right? It was Inigo Montoya's biggest nightmare. He would always be like, who killed my father? Everyone killed my father. It's changed, right? So fantastic job with the hands and with the eyes. And if we think about, there's a concept of the uncanny valley where something looks realistic, but not realistic enough to be real. And it just looks weird and uncanny. It's not cute, but it's not real. That's where a lot of AI-generated imagery had been maybe 3 months ago. But now it looks real. The other thing I'll say is it's much more creative in what I call functional novelty, to come up with something truly new, but also novel. I gave it the prompt of, you know, create a minor league baseball team called the Portland Hipsters, and it has this really cool hipster mug with the bottom is a beard of the mug, and it just looks fantastic. Like it is a really good logo, and I love it. It also does a good job mimicking styles. So the Studio Ghibli example is great. I gave the example of a dog, my dog Athena, that I mentioned earlier in the podcast episode. I took an image that I had created, that I'd drawn of Athena, and then cleaned up via AI on Adobe. And then I said, you know, generate an image of Zeus. And I showed a picture of my dog Zeus. And it really mimicked my style in a fantastic way. I was really impressed. So that's where we are. It's much more creative. It's much more comprehensive. And that's all on the visual style. I worry about this. I worry about copyright violations, something I brought up if you read my book, The AI Roadmap. I worry about what it means for artists and designers. I'm worried about how it might be weaponized for deep fakes and catfishing, which again, I brought up in the AI roadmap as well. So I'm not someone who's like just totally bullish on AI. I'm worried myself. I am someone who makes podcasts and makes videos and makes texts and books. And I don't want to outsource that to AI. I want to do that stuff myself. And then we have changes that are going on in general AI as well, text-based AI. So you probably have noticed that it takes longer when you do an AI prompt, and that's because it's engaging in deeper reasoning, and that deeper reasoning is making it better at creativity and problem solving. So if you're having it problem solving code or creating an image, either way, it's going to do a much better job than it could a year ago. So what does that mean for us, right? Like, where do we land? This feels big, it feels overwhelming. And so I wanna share 7 ways that generative AI is gonna change creativity. I'm not saying that these are good. I'm not saying that they're bad. They just are, and that's a reality. So given this reality, let's dive into the seven changes that we're going to see. Number one, we need to figure out when to use the centaur approach and the cyborg approach. I just finished rereading Ethan Mollick's book, Co-Intelligence, and I love that book, by the way. It is a fantastic book. And it has me thinking about the metaphor he used at the end of this of the book. And it's the notion of the centaurs and the cyborgs. So the centaur divides the task between the human and the machine. So like, that's obviously like a centaur, half human, half machine. Well, I mean, the original centaur was, I think, what, half horse maybe, or goat? I don't even remember. It's how bad I am at my Greek mythology. I might lose my degree in history, or I guess minor in history. The human does some parts well, the AI does others, and we keep this rigid separation. It's collaborative, but it is separate. And you might see this in a writer who brainstorms ideas with ChatGPT, but then drafts and edits everything themselves. The machine offers structure, maybe some inspiration, but the creative decisions are done by the human. And this, by the way, is what I tend to do. I tend to really love using AI this way in this sort of cyborg piece, or doing the tasks that I hate doing, like writing certain emails, or you know, planning logistics for certain things, making rubrics, all that. But the cyborg, on the other hand, blends the work together between the AI and the machine in real time. It's less about switching roles and more about co-creating. A cyborg approach might look like someone generating ideas, asking questions, revising with AI feedback, and shifting directions midstream in a constant back and forth. And that happens constantly with this sort of cyborg approach. I have a friend who describes the writing process for him as being closer to that of a writer's room for a TV show. And I thought that was really interesting. He interacts with two characters that he prompted on AI, and he bounces the ideas back and forth. That is the cyborg approach. So Mollick argues that cyborgs tend to outperform centaurs, not because they rely more on AI, but because they've learned to weave it into their thinking as a kind of extended cognition. They're not outsourcing the work, they're enhancing their own abilities by tapping into what AI does really well, like generating ideas or testing variations or offering structure. And in terms of writing, I am definitely taking more of a cyborg approach myself in the editing phase, where I've trained a chatbot to play the role of a critic, an editor, a busy reader, and I'm just using it to get feedback, and then I'm changing and saying, what do you think of these changes I made? In this way, AI becomes more like a thought partner than a tool. So what that means for our students is that they will need to figure out, how do we take a centaur approach without creeping into cognitive atrophy? And then when do we choose to just create a rigid separation and take on the centaur approach instead of the cyborg? So it's gonna be interesting to see how our students approach it. They'll need to toggle between intuition, iteration, and between vision and revision. They'll need to determine where and when they should create the firm boundaries of a centaur, but they'll also need to figure out when to adopt that sort of cyborg approach. And again, the goal here is not to be rigid at all, right? We want to be flexible with our approach, but we want to do it in a way where we're not shifting into autopilot, right? So students are going to need to be intentional, even as this work itself is dynamic and fluid and just changing often. So that's number one. Number two, we will need to take a vintage innovation mindset. So vintage innovation is sort of, you've heard me talk about it before, I wrote a book on it, and it's sort of the overlap between old school and new, between tried and true practices and never tried practices, between best practices and next practices, between old approaches and new research. And it's everything from engineers using origami to design foldable spacecraft parts and then using 3D modeling for other pieces, or designers using biomimicry to solve complex engineering problems. It's any time that you blend together the old and the new in a creative way. I would argue that Hamilton is a great example of that, taking in these elements of hip hop into a sort of older vibe of the theater. And for what it's worth, I would love to see more of this happen in opera. Like, I love opera because my wife sang opera and got me into opera, and I really enjoy it. But I would love to see this blending of new musical genres with opera in a really creative, multimedia, but still live way. So what does that mean? Our students will need to take this vintage innovation process. They're going to need to figure out, when do I use AI and when do I use things that are hands-on? When do I use lo-fi tools? They're going to do things like a brainstorming session that might start with sticky notes and index cards, but then an AI-powered mind map, or a conversation in a Socratic seminar, but then they stop and they turn around and they engage with a chatbot through an inquiry process. So it's going to have to be human-centered, but AI-infused. And that's the heart of innovation. It's the notion of combining the depth of what's always worked with the reach of what's newly possible. But that leads me to the third idea, which is really similar, but it's that both the tactile and synchronous will be more important than ever in the future. Automation has reshaped creative work for the last 4 to 5 decades in just huge ways. Our tools make it faster and cheaper to create, to replicate, to distribute content. On one hand, the gatekeepers are gone and creative workers can put out content that reflect their own style. But it's also cheaper and has driven a race to the bottom for certain creative work. And this in turn has led to a premium on the human elements that can't be replicated. In particular, anything that is synchronous, in person, and tactile. So musicians no longer rely on album sales the way that they once did. Instead, they tour, they build community, and they create live experiences that cannot be automated. A handcrafted table from a local woodworker might cost 10 times more than a mass-produced one, in part because, well, it tells a story. It carries intention. In a world where digital art can be generated in mere seconds, people are seeking out what feels personal and even imperfect and authentic, as overused as that phrase may be. Automation didn't eliminate creative work. It raised the bar for what we value in it. And I can't prove this. I don't know why that was so hard for me to say, but I have a hunch that hand-painted artwork will carry a premium in the visual art spaces, and so will 3D art and sculpture, especially if it is imperfect. So let's think of another area of creativity, the concept of problem solving. Spreadsheets and calculators and stuff like that took away the need for tedious number crunching, but they also freed up the mental space for deeper analysis and creative thinking. Salespeople no longer spend hours making cold calls from a phone book. They build relationships, they tell stories, and they have conversations in real life. They meet people in physical locations. So as automation handles more of these repetitive tasks, the human elements become the differentiator. It's not just that we can offload certain things to the machines. It's more about what we choose to hold on to because we do it better. And this has me thinking about school for a moment. If AI can't easily generate video and audio content, I wonder if students are going to need to become really good at authentic performance. We often hear school districts talking about the need to teach prompt engineering, which is a valid thing. I actually fully support that. And I have created the fact cycle as a way to do this, right? But what about speech and debate? What about theater and improv? What about mock trial? These might not seem cutting edge, but I'm telling you, they are the things that students will need in terms of critical skills for the future. Because part of what will make it differentiated is their ability to communicate in a human way to other humans. Number four, AI-generated content will stretch creativity and spark innovation. When drum machines first came out, critics warned that this would be the end of the live drummer and the studio musician. They had reason for concern. Record companies wanting to maximize profits could easily say, let's not pay a human if a machine can do it instead. But something else emerged in the process: electronic music. If we think of rap and hip hop, that is an example of this automation at its best. Or we can think of EDM, and that is probably at its worst. But the notion is still the same. Either way, it is the concept of electronic music emerging from a tool that was supposed to replace, potentially, the live drummer. In the meantime, I think live drummers got really creative about sounding different from drum machines. So it pushed their process even more. Or more recently, if you think about T-Pain, who actually has this amazing voice, he's using autotune the wrong way to spark a new way of singing. Now, this isn't a new phenomenon. Technology has always shaped the arc of art. The invention of mirrors and lenses and new types of paint allowed artists to achieve incredible levels of realism. Think of lifelike portraits of the Renaissance, or later the precise light of the Dutch masters. But the invention of photography changed things almost overnight. Suddenly, realism was no longer the artist's domain, and the camera could capture it faster and maybe more accurately than the painter. But this didn't end art. It pushed art in a new direction. Artists leaned into what photography couldn't do. Things like emotion, abstraction, perspective, impressionism emerged as one of the earliest new innovations, with its blurry edges and fleeting light. And then you had the post-impressionist Van Gogh, who used bold brushstrokes to create an entirely new reality. And over the next century, we experienced, you know, the reductionist Dada art, wild surrealism with Salvador Dali, distinct cubism, and obviously Picasso, geometric humanism, 60s pop art, postmodern pastiche of the 80s, urban murals, and all kinds of fascinating street art. And each movement embracing distortion, imagination, irony, whatever it may be, and even photography, finding new innovations as well. And each of these came with the dire warnings of the so-called death of the art form, or the end of the artist. And you know what? It wasn't the end. Every single time, it pushed art in new, more creative directions. The more machines took over realism, the more artists leaned into new ways that pushed the boundaries of art. And I get it. Some people hate contemporary art. Some people hate modern art. Some people wish that we had paintings that looked more like the, you know, Renaissance, and that's fine. But me, I love it. I love the creative ways the technology pushed people into new directions. Number five, context and empathy will be more important than ever. AI agents do a fantastic job on sort of mimicking roles, but they aren't sentient. They exist in a space that's, okay, actually, they don't exist in a space at all. And that's kind of a challenge for anyone doing creative work, because if chatbots are doing this in a way where it's predictive and where they are being kind of cliche in certain ways, that they're not going to understand the nuance of space and place. In other words, they can't read the room. ChatGPT is unable to understand contextual reasoning. It doesn't know the local context of your school, your city, your region. It doesn't know the awkward thing that a student just said in the moment. And so what that means is artists are going to have to lean into contextual understanding, and they're going to have to lean into empathy as well. Number six, the line between curation and creation is going to get blurry. I once listened to a podcast interview with the legendary producer Rick Rubin, and he mentioned that he didn't have tons of musical talent. He wasn't the world's greatest audio engineer either. His secret talent was his taste. As he puts it, quote, the confidence that I have in my taste and my ability to express what I feel has proven helpful for artists. And so he's created these epic, iconic albums. And really what he has is his taste. Now, I would argue that if that's the case, if having taste is going to be more important than ever, and we think about this cycle of critical consuming leading to inspiration, leading to creative work, then that critical consuming on one hand and then creating on the other hand, the bridge between them is content curation. This is the ability to collect content, to evaluate it, to think critically about it, to be both a critic but also a fan, but also to situate it in context, to find connection between content, to do mashups. All of these things are a part of the curation process. And so in the future, when we think about creativity and the world of AI, our students will need to be better curators of content. And then number seven, the final concept is being distinct will matter more than ever. So I've described before the metaphor of vanilla, that AI tends to be derivative unless you really program it or prompt it not to. It will default to bland. It will default to cliche and derivative. And that's because it's using predictive analytics. It's using essentially convergent thinking. It's getting better though. It's getting more divergent. And given that reality, what our students will need to do is find their voice. They're going to have to be wildly and unabashedly different. They're going to have to find a style that is unique to theirs. And when you find your voice, it allows you to stand out in a sea of sameness. And so part of the future of writing in particular, but also the future of artwork, the future of theater, all these different things, is going to be, can you be original? Can you be distinct? Now, I want to end by saying these are all big changes. And some of these changes make me a little bit sad. Some of these changes make me excited. But the reality is, the changes are here to stay. And art is going to evolve. Creativity is going to evolve as well. And given this reality, teachers are going to play a profound role in helping students through these changes and evolutions so that we can prepare them to be makers and creators in a changing world. Hey, thank you for listening to this podcast. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoy it, would you leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, Amazon, wherever you're listening to it? Also click the little subscribe button and it'll show up in your feeds a little bit easier, faster. And tell a friend about it. That's always one of the best ways, is just word of mouth. Again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.